Welcome to Earth Matters, environmental justice stories from so-called Australia and around the world. Produced at the studios of 3CR on Wurundjeri Woiwurrung country in Naarm, Melbourne, and broadcast across the continent via the Community Radio Network. I pay my respects to elders past and present of the Wurundjeri Woiwurrung and of the many lands our content reaches. I recognise that sovereignty has never been ceded. This always was and always will be Wurundjeri Woiwurrung land. And I affirm that there can be no environmental justice without justice for First Nations people across the globe. I'm Mia Audrey.
I think that we need to be setting targets that are aligned with what science demands to avoid the worst consequences of climate change, not setting targets that deliver the best short-term shareholder outcomes for a small number of fossil fuel companies.
In September, the federal government made an announcement that sent shockwaves through the community of climate activists and advocates. A 2035 climate emissions target of 62 to 70% below 2005 levels. The lead up to the announcement saw hundreds of groups calling for an ambitious target, many advocating for net zero. Now they're left reeling. I wanted to hear from some of these groups about what happened and what's next. Today, I bring you interviews with two leaders in the climate advocacy space. David Morris, CEO of Front Runners and former CEO of the Environmental Defenders Office, and Karen Stark, Director at Farm Renewables Consulting and founder of the National Renewables in Agriculture Conference. Their unique perspectives, drawing on work with sports people and farmers respectively, highlight the disappointment and frustration many are feeling in the wake of these new targets, and how they're forging onwards with the work for a safer future. First up, here's David Morris. In his position as CEO of Front Runners, David facilitates player-led climate advocacy movements, providing avenues for sports people to speak up about climate change and the impacts it's having on their work and our world.
David, thank you so much for joining me on Earth Matters. In September, Front Runners published an open letter signed by 75 prominent athletes calling on the government to commit to an emissions reduction target of at least 75% below 2005 levels by 2035. We've since had the government announce a target of 62 to 70%. What was the feeling in the Front Runners team when the announcement was made?
The feeling when the announcement was made was obviously an acute one of disappointment. And the reason for that disappointment is that our team and the athletes that were involved in the open letter calling for a 75% target was that the target fell short of what science says or science demands of Australia in terms of achieving the future that we want. We got in the same week as the target, the National Climate Risk Assessment, and that paints a really dire picture for the consequences of not hitting 1.5 degrees or not even hitting under 2 degrees, so the two sort of lines in the Paris Agreement. And so when you get a target, which is an important signal to the community, to the participants in the economy, to industry about where you're going, there's a definite sense of disappointment that the ambition should be set higher. It should be an effective signal as to the urgency of this matter. And I don't think a broad range target of 62 to 70% did do that. And I don't think that I've heard any scientists say that that target is one that is aligned with what the science demands to achieve what we want to achieve or what we need to achieve in respect of climate action.
Absolutely. And it's true that we're not just talking about numbers. These targets have serious implications for our future. Could you speak a little to what these new targets could mean for sport?
The difficulty with a target that has a range as large as 62 to 70% is it doesn't provide the clarity necessary as to where we're going. 10 years is not a long time. And if we want to exceed, meet that 70%, hopefully go well beyond it to the 75% target and beyond that we said was achievable in the open letter that many credible sources have come out and said is not only achievable, it's the minimum necessary. There are significant bodies that have come out and said the science aligned target is net zero by 2035. So we're well below that. What we have here is an inadequate target to a woeful target, and people need to be given a clear directive that the government is serious about striving to hit that top end. And if it can, go above it. What it means for sport, this is about the physical impacts of climate change primarily, but they flow through everything. We're going to have more extreme weather. We're going to have seasons where it's too wet to play. Heat and humidity so brutal that it will cause shifts in our scheduling, that it will cause games to be cancelled. It will be extraordinarily disruptive. And it will be most disruptive for the most vulnerable in sport. So small grassroots clubs that have grounds that are so compacted they're unsafe to play on, it'll affect those climate exposed remote reaches of the country even more extreme in a more even more extreme sense than it will sort of some of the more wealthy and socioeconomically advantaged parts of the country. So that's a real tragedy, I think, with climate impacts more generally. They will hit all of us and everyone, but they will hit the most vulnerable the hardest. And sport is something that is something everyone can do. Everyone can participate in sport. I like being in the sports and climate industry because of the breadth of the audience. 14 million Australians participate in sport. You add in volunteers, you add in administrators, and you've got the vast majority of the population in Australia that has some touch point with sport. But climate change is going to make it harder to play. So it's unsurprising that you had athletes coming out and saying, we want the next generation of athletes to have the same kind of safe conditions we have had and enjoyed, and they're not likely to have that. The disruption associated with climate change, I think, is difficult to appreciate. And it's one of the reasons I think it's a useful microcosm is that it's something you do and love day to day. You go to sport every Saturday morning. So you can appreciate when a game gets washed out and you have to deal with the disappointment that your kid feels about that, you can immediately contextualize the concept that that's going to get worse. It's too hot to play. My kid's soccer match has been cancelled this afternoon because we're headed for record October temperatures in New South Wales today. So I know I'm going to have to deal with his disappointment this afternoon. And I can immediately appreciate somewhat more the idea that this will be a far more frequent occurrence in 2050 than it will be now. That it will be potentially so frequent as to frustrate the entire sort of sporting landscape as we know it if we don't act with urgency on climate change.
In your conversations with athletes and other workers in the industry, do you find climate change is already front of mind, or is this a conversation that front runners is introducing to the space often?
I think it's a bit of a mix. You've got athletes that are very engaged with this topic, but whether you call it climate change or extreme weather or extreme heat, people are experiencing a shift in the climate and in weather patterns already. That's very clear. We did a report with a number of other groups that looked at the extreme heat being experienced by cricketers in India and Sri Lanka, and I think it was something like over 70% of matches already being played in those countries were being affected by hazardous heat, and that's likely to increase. My own personal experience at the moment is with kids in junior football, and we've had a season that was almost completely washed out. And what you observe in that is the lack of preparedness for that kind of extreme weather, grounds that don't drain well, inadequate shading. These are things that grassroots facilities are just not well equipped to address. So what we need to do is think about not only mitigation, we need to think about adaptation as well.
Course.
And we need to think about global leadership. And I think sport has an exceptionally important role to play in mobilising global leadership. Australia To use a sporting pun, punches above our weight in
Yeah.
terms of sport and influence on the global stage. And so sport athletes more generally have a unique ability to engage with the climate conversation globally. And this is a global conversation. Climate change will not be addressed by any particular nation state's actions individually, but that is not an excuse for individual nations to not do anything. The consequences are shared, the response must be shared as well.
I think you make a really good point. And especially when you do come across people who say, well, Australia's just small fry in the mix of this problem, right? And it can be used as an excuse for less action and less urgency. But recognizing our place within the sporting landscape and the cultural influence we can have there, I think is really helpful.
Yeah, I think the other flaw in the argument that Australia only contributes 1.2% of global emissions or somewhere around that is that it assumes we won't absorb any of the impacts of climate change.
Apart
We have
from it.
a really big vested interest in global leadership on climate change because we do not want to experience the consequences that the scientific consensus says will be wrought upon this country if we don't. And I think sport understands leadership. Sport understands how contributors from someone who might only make up a small percentage of, say, a total team can have an outsized impact on the game more generally. A captain's goal that turns the tide of a match. Well, I think the same kind of opportunity exists for Australia in demonstrating leadership on the transition here away from fossil fuels. We're obviously a nation state that has historically relied very heavily on fossil fuels, both in terms of our domestic energy generation, but also our emissions. But we're uniquely blessed in terms of our ability to contribute to a future that doesn't rely on those energy sources. And there's lots of solutions that exist at the moment, and we need to be pursuing those solutions that do exist now, with absolute haste.
Absolutely. Well, I'm sure listeners can hear the breadth of your expertise in this conversation, David, and I'm really grateful to you for coming on. I'd be loath to admit the fact that before you were the CEO of FrontRunners, you worked in the Environmental Defender's Office for over a decade. Can you tell us anything about the government's decision-making process behind these new targets for those who are still reeling from it?
There's probably two things to say. So the government was compelled to provide this new target by its commitment to the Paris Agreement. And the Paris Agreement does demand that you put forward your maximum level of ambition. So I think that added to the disappointment because it felt there was a huge amount of really robust evidence that stands for the proposition that this target, 62 to 70%, is not Australia's maximum ambition. I think the other thing that I would urge is a willingness to set courageous targets, set a courageous vision for our country, and then chase it, rather than being timid or craven about missing the bottom of a range because of uncertainty. I think we should get comfortable with the idea that we're going to go big and we're going to set forth to achieve something great, and if we fall short, be okay with that. I can't imagine to sort of bring it back to sport, I can't imagine too many fans of a sporting team being fabulously excited with a club that said, we want to be really ambitious. We want to be really realistic in our assessment of the year's prospects, and we're really gunning for the wooden spoon, because we think that's a realistic
Or
proposition
even
for our team
fourth or
this year.
tenth in the league. Yeah,
Right.
you can't imagine.
But coming back to your question, the target and the Climate Change Authority's advice on the target, as it notes in its report, did engage with multiple sectors of the community, including sectors of the community that urged a less ambitious target. Now, I wasn't there for the ins and outs of that process, but you see some of the debate around this target and some of the areas of particularly industry in the country that have a real vested interest in a slower transition. And I think that's a problematic influence on Australian politics and on Australian culture more generally. I think that we need to be setting targets that are aligned with what science demands to avoid the worst consequences of climate change, not setting targets that deliver the best short-term shareholder outcomes for a small number of fossil fuel companies. That's an influence on this debate in this country, which is oversized and problematic. And I think that it's important for anyone engaging on this topic to recognize the influence that fossil fuel companies have on this debate, and really appreciate the deeply vested interest that they have, the deeply conflicted position that they have, being concerned more about the delivery of shareholder value than the delivery of safety for future generations, which is where I think governments and the general population would expect governments' focus to be.
Well, thank you for your leadership. And I'm wondering if you have any parting words for anyone listening, especially those who want to channel their particular passion into advocacy and action.
What targets do is translate to policy. And so I think the opportunity now is to engage as forcefully as community groups can to try and drive the policy shifts necessary. And they happen right across the economy, right across the different sectors, and range from things like how much are you putting into storing carbon in the land, how much are you retrofitting buildings, and getting gas out of building supply. These are the types of things that you can actively push for now. There's some really great initiatives, I think, to give a shout out and a plug to Cricket for Climate and Footy for Climate, two organisations that we work really closely with. They're doing some great grassroots initiatives around putting battery and solar systems into local sports clubs. These are great initiatives because they have both a mitigation and adaptation response to climate change, but they also provide a tangible example of the shift in communities that might not be engaging with this topic. They provide a conversation point. What we need to get to is a race to the top for climate ambition. We need to get to a point where that is seen as a sensible and evidence-aligned approach. And you only get there, I think, when the public is there. And so you've got to speak to a broad audience. We need to keep having the conversations because I think the enemy of action will be apathy, despondency, disappointment. The outcomes that we see in the world through climate change, I don't think will be influenced by those emotions. They'll be influenced by people pushing those emotions, which are natural, to one side and continuing with the crucial work of convincing the population at a scale necessary to say a race to the top for climate ambition is something that is very, very publicly popular in this country. That's where we need to get to. We need all politicians, irrespective of their views about this issue, to know that this is a publicly popular thing to act on right across the country. And that means, I think, engaging with people in a way that allows them to tangibly understand and appreciate the impacts of this on things that they love, whatever that might be.
Well, thank you so much for your words. Thanks for joining me on Earth Matters and really appreciate the important work you're doing.
Thanks so much, man. Been nice to chat.
David Morris, CEO of Frontrunners, on setting aside apathy to push for urgent climate action and protect the things we love. You're listening to Earth Matters, Community Radio's National Environmental Justice Program. We're hearing from climate advocates in the wake of the government's emission target announcement about why 62 to 70% below 2005 levels is not enough and what needs to be done. Next up, Karen Stark, Director at Farm Renewables Consulting and founder of the National Renewables in Agriculture Conference. I spoke with Karen about farmers' experiences at the front lines of climate change and her work reframing the renewable energy transition as an opportunity rather than a threat.
All right, Karen, thanks so much for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
So we've been hearing a lot of community groups criticizing the 2035 climate targets. What's been your response and those of the farming communities that you work with?
Look, I think, we really need stronger targets to really address the types of impact that we're seeing already on our farms in Australia. I live on a farm in Narromine, New South Wales, and we've had many years, about 4 years, I think, of quite extreme weather events. So droughts followed by flooding, which meant we couldn't put crops in, things like that. And this year was actually the first year we've been able to pick a cotton crop on time and as expected for about 4 years. So really these climate impacts that we talk about are already happening on Australian farms. So personally, I would prefer to see a stronger necessary target than the one that's been put forward by the Australian government.
Yeah, absolutely. And I imagine that these impacts are being felt by a lot of people in not just your area, but across the continent. What have you noticed for how farmers are coping with the changes they're seeing? And how do things like on-farm renewable projects fit into increasing communities' resilience?
Look, when we have more unpredictable weather and extreme weather events, which changes the way that you can crop or the number of cattle or sheep that you have, that's a very stressful situation for most farmers. During the drought around 2018 to 2020, our neighbours had to sell a lot of their animals, or they also had to buy very expensive feed because there just was nothing growing in the ground to feed these animals. So that impact on food production, on family farms, and in regional communities is pretty severe, really. And like I said, for us, we're cropping, and we weren't able to put in crops. We've seen just 2 days ago we had a pretty massive hail event as well. So we're seeing this more unpredictable weather, which is aligned to what the climate change predictions are likely to be. And so when you talk about renewables, we have two types of situations on farm renewables where that can help farmers like ourselves, and we've tried to do cut emissions as well as cut your input costs. And when you're able to reduce your input costs, that's energy being quite a massive cost to most businesses, you're really helping to build resilience for the times that you might not have an income because there's no crops to be grown, or you've had to sell animals, or you've had to buy feed in. And then there's obviously the larger energy transition, which is solar, wind, and transmission to replace all our retiring coal-fired power stations. And that can be quite contentious in regional areas, but we do know it's the cheapest form and cleanest form of new energy. So it's really important that these rollouts of renewable energy zones or large-scale renewables are done fairly, respectfully, and include communities as partners, not just kind of putting it on them, but doing it with us would be the ideal scenario.
And you did collaborate with Farmers for Climate Action on a report about this, something called Farm Powered, which outlines opportunities for regional communities in the renewable energy boom. I'm wondering, what is the mood in general? Is this transition more so seen as an opportunity, or is it sometimes or often seen as a threat?
I think the large-scale energy transition, there's a lot of voices out there, and they're probably the minority, can see it as a threat. Whereas, no one's forcing a farmer to host solar and wind. That's all, a decision that you're able to make as a business. And it really, as you would have heard, drought proofs farms because you can earn hundreds of thousands every year from hosting this infrastructure and still farm under solar panels if it's designed correctly in the right way. You can still graze sheep and cattle or crop around wind turbines, usually about 98% of the land you can still use. So it's not that it's taking away farming, but it's actually adding a diversified income stream, which is so critical to regional communities and farms during these more extreme weather events. So while there are people that feel that they don't want the landscapes to change, and I understand that, or they feel that developers or governments haven't been putting forward their plans very inclusively or respectfully, I think there's a lot of people that are starting to see that this is an opportunity if it's done correctly, and if they get involved early enough and talk to others in the community, leaders, councils, CWAs, land care groups, it can be really a huge opportunity for a once-in-a-lifetime investment into regional Australia.
And if there are folks listening who are hearing that and thinking, oh, I want to do something myself, especially if they're curious about on-farm renewables or want to support your work, maybe they have a farm and want to explore options, how can they engage? What are next steps for them?
Well, I'd say, if you come to the Renewables and Agriculture Conference, the next one's in New South Wales, rather than Victoria, on the 12th of August in Orange, that I've had people say to me, like, it was so good to meet other people that have got similar mindsets. Because sometimes, like you said, there can be just a few here and there. You know, it's not the overwhelming sentiment of some communities. So, you know, that's one way if you want to meet people working on farms or with farmers, trying to do the right thing or trying to understand what needs to happen. That would be my first option. Otherwise, reaching out to groups like Farms for Climate Action, obviously, that's a really strong not-for-profit group with, I think, 8,000 farmers and more like 50,000 members of people that recognize that we need to be doing more, that are trying to, you know, inform themselves and do more on their own farms around climate action and also share that with others in their network. So groups like that, or ReAlliance is a good one as well, where it's community based and trying to ensure meaningful benefits for regional communities out of the energy transition. So getting involved in groups like that and trying to see who else might be in your area is always, I guess, helpful.
Well, thank you so much for joining me and sharing. It's awesome to hear about your work, and I hope there's a few people out there who are going to find that next step and stay engaged and stay positive as best they can.
Yeah, me too. Thank you so much, Mia.
Karen Stark, renewables in agriculture advocate, on how farmers and supporters can seize the opportunity presented by the energy transition. You've been listening to Earth Matters, Community Radio's National Environmental Justice Program. I'm Mia Audrey. We've heard from two climate advocates about how their communities are responding to our government's inaction. Frontrunners and renewables in agriculture are just two of many examples of how frontline communities are reframing their vulnerable position as an opportunity. For sports people, farmers, and all of us witnessing disturbing changes in our climate, the call is to seize the power of our stories, to move through the disappointment and fear, and find our voice in the movement for greater action. If you're looking to step into this work, you'll find links to the organisations mentioned and more in the show notes for this episode via 3cr.org.au/earthmatters. And for those already deeply engaged, know that you're not alone in your frustration, and that there are far more of us than in the backroom negotiations behind our government's weak commitments. Thanks for listening. That's all for now. But tune in next week for the first part of two, exploring how to talk to kids about climate change. Earth Matters would like to thank the Community Broadcasting Foundation for their financial support and the Community Radio Network for getting the program out to you. Earth Matters is produced in the studios of 3CR, NAM, Melbourne.
Hello there, I'm Virginia from The Gardening Show. What if there was a viable solution to climate change? Treasured Perennials Nursery are sponsoring a screening of Kiss the Ground documentary, exploring how, through our soils, we can stabilise the Earth's climate, restore lost ecosystems, and provide future food security. A mini event with stalls, demonstrations, and a Q&A session. It's going to be at Fernie Creek Horticultural Society, which is in Hilton Road in Sassafras, on November the 15th, 11:30 to 4 p.m. Tickets will be $15.50 through TryBooking. Head to trybooking.com and search for Kiss the Ground. All proceeds, of course, are donated to 3CR. Treasured Perennials Nursery is a 3CR supporter and regularly appear on The Gardening Show.
Tune in to Uprise Radio every first and third Wednesday of the month at 5:30 p.m. on 3CR.
With Jackson and James, we're bringing you the in-depth analysis of what's happening in the world all in just 30 minutes. You can listen live to air or you can find us on demand.
3cr.org.au. Stay tuned.
You're listening to 3CR, an apartheid-free zone. 3CR's Committee of Management has passed a declaration formalising our commitment to a free Palestine. As an apartheid-free zone, we're committed to boycotting Israel's regime of oppression We stand firmly against apartheid in Palestine and encourage other organisations to join us in this struggle. Visit our website to read the full declaration and learn more about our commitment to justice and liberation for Palestine and the Apartheid Free Zone movement.